I'm Steve Potter, and this is Cityscape. Later, French guitarist Gael Solal will perform live here on Cityscape in advance of her first concert in St. Louis tomorrow. But we begin with the story of a man named Pulitzer. It's a famous name not only in St. Louis, but around the world, and a new book, Classic Modern, The Art Worlds of Joseph Pulitzer, Jr., tells his story. And while most of what's written about him is written about what he did in relation to the newspaper, the family business, this biography gives readers an insight into the man that built one of the greatest private art collections of the 20th century. Marjorie B. Cohn is the author of Classic Modern, The Art Worlds of Joseph Pulitzer. Jerry Cohn, welcome to Cityscape.
Thank you.
May I begin, with your permission, by reading the first couple of sentences
Sure.
from your book and just have you comment on it? I think it sets the stage rather well. Joseph Pulitzer, the name of the firstborn son, the epitome of privilege and obligation. It forecast a boy's life of gardenias on the breakfast tray and a man's life of commanding leadership in American journalism. Improbably, that life was also a life in modern art.
Yes, in modern art, with an emphasis on modern, I would say. He lived in many modern art worlds, and I think one reason that it's important to talk about him here in St. Louis is that many people only are familiar with him as a collector because of the works of art in the St. Louis Art Museum that he gave, especially the major Matisse painting that he bought at the Nazi degenerate art auction. But he had other art worlds that were very important here in St. Louis, and so the book is about a lot of those, his commissioning of architecture and his work with the newspaper itself to bring modern art to St. Louis in the 40s and 50s, his work with the Grand Center redevelopment, all of those things he was equally dedicated to.
Well, it's quite a book. There's a lot in there. It's not a coffee table book. I mean, it's a serious book.
Yes, it's serious, but there are a lot of great color reproductions that I hope people enjoy.
And some personal photographs as well.
Yes.
Let's talk about the man, if we could, for a moment. He was born in St. Louis in 1913.
Yes.
As a young boy who moved out to an area of Ladue, Lone Tree Farm, was it?
Yes. Ladue was really the country then, and it was really a farm with, you know, sheep and cows and the rest of it. It got built up as a suburb years later after he moved out there.
And he continued to live there, I guess, on and off through his life, didn't he?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
After his stepmother sold the larger property after her husband had died, he had built a summer house on land he had bought from his father and lived in that for the rest of his life, summers. He always had a house on Pershing Place in Central West End for the winters. It's interesting. As a rich man, you would think he would have a vacation home, as many rich people do. I suppose from this part of the world, they go to the Southwest, to Tucson or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But because he was the editor of the paper, he could never leave St. Louis. So he built his summer home in St. Louis and moved from house to house, but never left town.
Hmm. It's interesting. Would you explain the book's title?
Classic Modern refers to his taste in modern, which he himself admitted to. And it started by being a taste for what you think of as the classic modern artists, like Matisse and Picasso. But he moved on to artists that are very contemporary, like Pollock and Warhol and Serra and other minimalist sculptors. But he always preferred them in their most collected and formal phase. Even in an artist like Max Beckmann, whom he also appreciated and knew when he was here in St. Louis, he liked Beckmann at his most collected, I guess you would say, his least messy.
So journalist / art collector. Signs of both were evident, of interest in both were evident at a fairly young age, weren't they?
At a very young age. It's hard to know how he actually discovered artists like Matisse and Van Gogh, whose works he hung in reproduction in his room at prep school. I mean, they're commonplace now, but they certainly weren't in the 1920s in terms of an adolescent boy going to prep school. When he went to Harvard, He was failing out his first year, taking the courses his father wanted him to take, taken for preparation in journalism, like government and philosophy and history. And he was on academic probation. And he discovered art history and ended up being honors eligible by the time he was graduating. He did so well in art. And I think that the years before the Second World War, he was really torn about shedding journalism and moving into an art career, not as an artist, but as a museum person.
You mentioned Harvard. Before we go any further, you're retired from the Harvard Art Museums.
Yes.
And you had a long relationship with both he and his second wife, Emily, for a long time.
Yes, closer with Emily because she was there as a young assistant curator when I was a graduate student. And we became good friends, and I went to work at Harvard after I got my master's and stayed good friends until she moved here to St. Louis to be the curator of the City Art Museum. Joe Pulitzer at the time...
And when you, for jumping in, when you say city, we should say that's what we know as the St. Louis Art Museum
right.
Now because we have another one by
it
that name.
It changed its name. Uh-huh. That's right. It changed its name in 72 or something like that. But when she came out in 64, it was still the city. Joe Pulitzer was a patron of the Harvard Art Museums because he was a rich and distinguished collector at this point and was on their committees. And so she as a curator and me as a conservator at that point knew him in a rather distant way, I guess you would say. He was not a personal friend the way she was. When she moved out to St. Louis, she became closer to Joe Pulitzer, of course, as a curator in his hometown museum. But it wasn't until after his wife died, and, you know, several years after, obviously, that they got engaged and then got married.
First wife was Lulu.
First wife was Lulu, and they had a happy marriage until her death in 68. I, of course, had stayed friendly with her, and in fact, and my husband and I are very interested in opera, and we would come out to hear opera theater here and stay with them when we came now and then, you know, not every year, but so we stayed in touch.
That must have been a nice experience.
Oh, yes, and after she married Joe, you know, and would come with him to visit back to Harvard, I would see them here back in Cambridge.
So... What was he really like then? Because in your book you talk about during his years at running the Post-Dispatch, particularly after his father died and he was in complete charge, that some people that worked there found him a little distant.
I think that that was a kind of professional distancing, that he felt that he wasn't going to be chummy with everybody. He certainly was very kind in the most generous and hospitable way to his wife's early friends. I mean, he had no reason to know me except as somebody who worked at the Fog, but when I turned up as his wife's good old friend, he became my good old friend. I mean, he was a very genial, social man in his private life with the people he chose to be.
It sounded like quite the dance, dandy as well.
Yes.
When you talk about his college years, something that keeps coming up is his good looks, his fashion sense, his sort of flair for decorating. About his college living quarters.
As elegant, he had a grand piano. He had a rug on the floor, which at least at Harvard in those days was truly out of the ordinary. And he did not hang out with the football players. He took the train down to New York and went to art galleries, and that was pretty strange. And it must have been even stranger when he brought a Modigliani home that is now a star at the St. Louis Art Museum, but in that point lived in his dorm room.
Can you go back and pinpoint the first piece of art he purchased when that all began? Are you able to do that?
Yes. The first serious art he bought was a painting by a woman artist named Jane Berlandina that he bought in San Francisco between his junior and his senior year at college when, with his father's instigation, he was serving in an internship at a newspaper in San Francisco. And he kept that painting, and he liked that painting. He also bought a painting by André Derain, a French School of Paris artist, that he traded in at a later date for other art, and so we don't know what that looked like. But the big painting, the big first purchase, was the Modigliani, which is a major Modigliani and, as I say, a star at the St. Louis Art Museum. He gave it in memory of his first wife some years later, of course. And that he bought when he was a senior. Then the year he graduated from Harvard, he went to Europe on a post-graduation gift tour, you know, that sort of thing. And he came home through New York and he bought six Picassos. Hmm.
And eventually his interest went beyond paintings and so forth to architecture.
Yes, to architecture, to sculpture, to commissions, which are very different from buying from a dealer. If you're commissioning an artist to make something, you don't know what you're going to get. And this is a kind of confidence in the artist that is rare.
Do we know how his father felt about his art collecting, spending whatever it was that he spent
at the time? Oh, his father felt very dim about this.
Yeah, they had some differences.
It was a difficult relationship. And one of the great stories in terms of a disappointment for Joe was Joe had the chance to buy Picasso's Demoiselle d'Avignon, the great painting that's now in MoMA that's considered the beginning of Cubism. And his father wouldn't give him an advance on his allowance, so he couldn't buy it. He had a big enough allowance that he could buy smaller Picassos, not necessarily lesser, but smaller.
Pretty good allowance.
But he couldn't buy – well, Demoiselle d'Avignon was only $30,000 then, which is very different from what it would be valuable – what it would be valued for now. The art that he brought home was so different from his parents' sense of decor. And his life as an adult, of course, was going to be different. When he came home from college, they gave him the room over the garage at the house, and he redecorated it in high modern style, all gray and plain. And his father went up one day and looked around and said, "He must be sick to live." And his sister called it the mortuary.
He served for a time in the service, didn't he, during World War II? So I'm wondering, did that interrupt his...
It interrupted his life here in St. Louis, of course. And I think it made a man of him in the sense that he really was hesitating about being a serious journalist before the war. He was hesitating about settling down in many different ways. And he got very serious very quickly with his war service. He saw active duty in the South Pacific for 4 years, both in on shipboard in Hawaii and at Iwo Jima. And he came home, I think, a much more serious and adult person.
Could we talk a little bit about two things, his impact here in St. Louis and his impact, I guess, globally? First, let's start in St. Louis. He was involved at some point really with revitalizing, I guess, part of downtown.
Yes.
The Twain, the Serra sculpture, and other things.
He tried to stay out of the public eye as much as he could because he felt that as an editor of the newspaper, he shouldn't be taking positions. But there's no doubt that behind the scenes he was supporting his wife, Emily's very public interest in Twain. But he also was supporting other things, like he wanted at first to be behind a redevelopment at the riverfront, which I gather never really got off the ground in the way it might. And then he was very much behind the Grand Center redevelopment at the end of his life. And he wanted badly to renovate as a museum of contemporary art a old automobile assembly factory on Olive Street, where I guess the television studios now are. He died before that would happen, but they had already hired Tadeo Ando to consider that project. So ultimately, the Pulitzer Foundation for the Arts, which, of course, he never knew, was a result of his ambitions for Grand Center.
You mentioned the Foundation for the Arts, and I was thinking back to the Twain piece, the Richard Serra.
Yes.
I remember from being a young kid that there was a certain amount of controversy over that. A lot of people didn't care for it. Was he involved in that?
There still is a lot of controversy about that.
Yeah.
He had great faith in Serra, and one of the commissions on his private land was Serra's first outdoor site-specific commission, which Twain is a kind of descendant of. And they bought Serra sculptures of other kinds. So he was very much behind the creation of Twain. and very aware of the controversy, in part because the Globe Democrat, his rival newspaper, if you will, was very much against it, as you may or may not remember, was running contests about how to demolish it and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So it got to be a very open conflict between the Globe Democrat and the Post-Dispatch that he couldn't help but notice.
What about his impact globally?
I would say that his impact globally is probably through his collection, because he was always very generous with collecting. And he would lend to shows that wanted. He would welcome visitors to his house. People assumed it was a public collection, and they wouldn't realize that the Pulitzer collection with a capital P and a capital C, they wouldn't assume they'd have to ask whether anybody would be home, you know, that sort of thing. So he was much more, we would say, friendly and less ambitious in a way. He wasn't a competitive collector, but much friendlier and open than many collectors have been.
How concerned was he about what would happen to his collection once he passed?
He wasn't, because he was never a seller in the sense of wanting to dispose of things at auction or see what the value of things were. He never doubted that his works of art would go to public institutions, particularly ones that he favored in his lifetime, like Harvard and St. Louis. And he always thought that things like house museums or home collections that emphasized a single collector were dead once the collector died. And so he had no intention to enshrine his collection like Frick did, you know, or Freer did, or in any of the collections you must be familiar with as house collections.
One final question. How was Emily Pulitzer involved in the creation of this book?
Well, she was the one who essentially told me, Jerry, you must do this. I have a scholarly specialty in collection histories, and I've written several books about other collectors. And she told me after Joe died, she wanted me to write Joe's history. And I said, I had a job. I can't do this. You know, I got other things to do. But once I retired, she said, okay, Jerry, now you have to do it. So she gave me access to all of his papers and gave me a place to stay when I came out to do the research.
We've been talking with Marjorie Cohn, Jerry Cohn. She's the author of Classic Modern, The Art Worlds of Joseph Pulitzer Jr. And we've really just hit the tip of the iceberg, because there are so many stories about relationships he had with artists and dealers and buying particular works and behind-the-scenes sort of things. It's really fascinating. And I'm sure this is available at all good bookstores?
Well, I don't know. It's certainly at Left Bank Books here at St. Louis.
Jerry Cohn, thanks so much. It's Classic Modern, The Art Worlds of Joseph Pulitzer Jr. We thank you for being on the program today.
Thank you.
And coming up next on Cityscape, French guitarist Gael Solal. This is St. Louis Public Radio.